She was with her best friend, witnessing these glorious creatures act like the wild animals they were born to be. After everything she'd been through, she never dreamt it was possible to feel this happy, even though it wasn't her choice to join the circus and she despised her job. She wouldn't give up this moment for anything in the world. Cole took off his shoes and started unbuttoning his shirt. "What are you doing?" Lily said. "Going swimming." "You're crazy," she said. He smiled and pulled off his shirt. "Well, I'm hot, too." When he started unbuckling his belt, she looked away, went over to a flat-topped boulder, and sat down. She plucked a tall stalk of timothy from the grass and concentrated on pulling off the blades. Despite the fact that she had seen numerous men, freaks, clowns, and performers alike, in various stages of undress, the thought of seeing Cole in his undershorts unsettled her. The other sideshow women always joked that with Lily's perfect features and Cole's fair complexion and muscular physique, the two of them would make beautiful angel-haired babies. Lily shushed them and said she didn't think of Cole that way. He was her best friend, and that was it. Except it wasn't entirely true. She wasn't sure when her feelings for him had started to change, or when she stopped ignoring them. She only knew they had. And she wasn't sure what to do. They had been best friends for nearly 6 years, but he wasn't in love with her. She was a 15-year-old albino who worked in the sideshow, and at 18, Cole was the lead performer in the elephant show. He could be with anyone he wanted. The trapeze artist Natasha was his age, and so was Chloe, the tightrope walker. They were beautiful girls with perfect figures, smooth, rosy skin, and shiny hair, who wore fancy costumes covered with feathers and glittering jewels. She had seen them watching Cole out of the corner of their eyes, sizing him up and down and whispering behind their hands, wondering why he spent so much time with a freak and paid so little attention to them. She wondered, too. "You coming in?" he said. She glanced at him and laughed. "No." The lantern light reflected off his bare chest and muscular shoulders, and heat rose in her cheeks. She wanted to watch the elephants, but went back to picking apart the timothy instead. "Come on," he said. "Don't be a chicken. It's hotter than Hades tonight." She looked up at him again. "I'm not chicken. I don't have my swimsuit with me." He raised one eyebrow. "Since when do you own a swimsuit?" She grinned. He knew perfectly well she didn't own a swimsuit. Then, before she knew what was happening, he rushed over, scooped her into his arms, and headed for the water. She screeched, then put a hand over her mouth. What if someone heard? "Put me down," she said as loud as she dared. She pushed against his bare shoulders, trying to get him to release her, but he was too strong. "I'll put you down," he said, laughing, "right in the water." "Okay, stop," she said. "I'll go in. Just let me take off my sandals." He set her on the bank and straightened. "That dress will weigh you down and wrap around your legs. Better take that off, too." She took off her sandals and tossed them on the bank, toward the rock where she'd been sitting. On one hand, she wanted to cool off and play in the pond with Cole and the elephants. She wasn't afraid of the water. On the other hand, she had never been swimming in her life and wasn't crazy about the idea of being in her underwear in front of Cole. She had changed her clothes in front of men and women alike getting ready for the sideshow, but this was different. An image of them naked together flashed in her mind, and a strange sensation fluttered in her abdomen. She turned away and undid the thin belt around her waist, then pulled her dress over her head, thankful she had worn her long-legged panties. She stood for a minute, her dress bunched in her hands over her brassiere, then took a deep breath and turned to face Cole, her heartbeat thudding in her ears. To her surprise, he was gone. He was already running into the pond, his long legs cutting through the water. She let out her breath and watched him dive in, disappear, and surface a few yards away. Jojo moved toward him, his mouth open in what looked like a smile. Cole swam over and climbed on Jojo's back. His tanned skin looked even darker now that it was wet. Lily looked down at her arms. They were white sticks, like the limbs of a skeleton. She fumbled with her dress and hurried to put it back on.
"What are you doing?" Cole said. "I thought you were coming in. Come on, it feels great."
He slipped off Jojo's back and swam toward shore.
"I don't know how to swim," she said.
"That's all right," he said. "I'll teach you."
He rose out of the water and took her hand. She hesitated, then dropped her dress in the grass and followed him into the pond. The water was cold. She drew in a sharp breath and scrunched her shoulders. Pebbles and mud squished between her toes. He let her in farther, laughing.
"Don't worry, you'll get used to it."
When she was in up to her waist, he told her to lie across his arms and paddle with her hands while kicking her legs. She leaned forward, but when her stomach and chest touched the water, her breath caught and she straightened. It felt like ice on her hot skin. Cole smiled and waited patiently. After a minute, she gathered the courage to lean across his arms again, and this time the pond didn't feel as cold. He held her up and she kicked and paddled, doing her best to follow his instructions.
"You're doing great," he said.
Then her face accidentally went under, and she swallowed a mouthful of water. She put her feet on the bottom and stood, coughing and wiping her face.
"You okay?" he said.
She nodded, and when she could breathe again without coughing, said,
"It's harder than I thought. It takes practice. Hold on, I want to try something."
He moved toward the elephants, who were soaking near the center of the pond like submerged boulders.
"Pepper, come," he said.
Pepper lifted her head and seemed to float toward him. He gestured toward Lily, and Pepper swam in her direction and emerged next to her at the edge of the pond, water dripping from her wide head and body, like a barge rising from the deep. Lily reached out to touch Pepper's trunk.
"Hi, beautiful."
Pepper wrapped her trunk around Lily's waist and picked her up, pulling her off the bottom of the pond. Lily gasped with delight and put a hand on Pepper's forehead for balance. Pepper lifted her over her head and placed her on the back of her neck. Cole's eyes went wide with surprise.
"Did you give the lift command?" he said.
"No," she said. "I thought about it, but she did it before I could say anything."
"That's amazing. I've never seen her do anything without being told."
Lily smiled.
"Maybe she likes me."
"Of course she does."
Cole swam over to Petunia, who was up to her shoulders in the water, and climbed on. He steered her toward the middle of the pond, and Pepper followed. Lily hung on to Pepper's ears, lolling from side to side, as the water washed up and over her legs and waist. She felt perfectly safe because, somehow, she knew Pepper was aware of her limitations. Jojo and Flossie came too. Moonlight reflected off the rippling waves as the massive gray beasts moved gracefully across the pond. Lined up one after the other in their own private parade. The only sounds were the elephants' grunts and snorts, and water lapping against their bodies. Cole looked over his shoulder and smiled at Lily, but neither said a word. She felt like she had died and gone to heaven. Her heart felt about to burst with happiness and awe. Never in a million years did she think she'd be riding an elephant across a pond. It felt like a dream. Cole turned Petunia back to the other shore, and when the water was shallow enough, he slid down from her back. Lily did the same, and Cole was there to catch her.
"Come here," he said. "I want to try something else."
He took her hand, pulled her toward the shoreline, and looked back at the elephants.
"Pepper, come."
Pepper did as she was told and followed them out of the pond. Cole stopped on the grassy bank, and Pepper came to a halt beside him.
Steady, he said to her. What are you doing? Lily said. She squeezed the water out of her hair and looked around for her dress. When she saw it, she picked it up and held it out, trying to figure out which end was up.
Never mind about that right now, Cole said. I need you to come over here.
Lily dropped the dress and went to his side.
What?
Stand in front of Pepper and give the command back. He positioned Lily in front of the waiting animal.
Why? Lily said. What do you...
Just humor me, okay? Lily shrugged, looked at Pepper, and said, back. Pepper moved back.
Now say, go on, Cole said.
Go on, Lily said. Pepper moved forward. Cole grinned.
Tell her to stand up.
Why? Lily said.
I don't understand the point of me telling her what to do.
She's a trained circus elephant. She knows all the commands.
Standing on their hind legs is uncomfortable for elephants. Pepper's trainer and I have a hard time getting her to do it. Most of the time she refuses.
Lily regarded Pepper. She didn't want to tell her to do anything. Pepper wasn't supposed to be here, in this remote field in the middle of Iowa. She was supposed to be free, wandering through the rainforests and jungles, not shackled to a post, traveling all over the country inside a boxcar, or doing tricks for a tent full of oblivious rubes. Every time she was with the elephants, Lily imagined she could feel their sadness as if it were her own. Not just Pepper's, but Flossie's and Petunia's and JoJo's too, even though he had no idea what he was missing. In the moonlight, she could see the scars from the bull hook on Pepper's head and shoulders. She could see the welts on her ankles from the chains. She could see the pain and sorrow in her intelligent amber eyes. With something that felt like lead in her heart, she knew there was nothing she could do to help them beyond showing them kindness whenever possible.
I don't want her to do something that makes her uncomfortable, she said.
It doesn't hurt her, Cole said. It's just difficult, like us standing on our heads. Lily sighed.
As long as it didn't injure Pepper, she supposed there was no harm in going along with Cole's game. Then Pepper could get back to swimming. She opened her mouth to tell her to stand, but before she could utter the word, Pepper lifted her front feet and stood on her hind legs. Cole's mouth fell open.
Holy shit, he said. How'd you do that?
How did I do what?
I didn't hear you give the command.
How do I tell her to get down?
Before Cole could answer, Pepper dropped her front feet and went back to standing on all fours.
Cole laughed. That's incredible! She'll do anything for you. It's like she can read your mind or something.
He called Flossie out of the pond. She came out and stood on the grass.
Tell her to lie down.
Lily shook her head.
I don't want to, she said. I don't like making them perform. Let them go back in the pond. They were having fun.
Just one more time, Cole said. Then we'll stop. Lily told Flossie to lie down. Flossie dropped to her elbows and knees, then rolled over on her side.
I knew it! Cole shouted.
Knew what?
Flossie hates lying down.
I have no idea what it is or how it works, but after what you did with that zebra and these elephants today, I have no doubt you have a gift, Lily. It's real. And after we show Mr. Barlow, you won't have to be the albino medium anymore.
Lily made a face. She didn't have a gift. The elephants liked and trusted her. That was all. Her cat Abby used to be the same way. She did what Lily wanted because they loved and trusted each other. Maybe people didn't give animals enough credit. They were smarter and had more feelings than anyone realized.
You're out of your mind. Besides, Mr. Barlow already has an elephant trainer.
Yeah, but you saw how he trains the bulls with chains and ropes. And the only way the trainer knows how to make them mind is by using a bull hook.
Lily dug a toe into the grass, trying to sort through her feelings. Even if she didn't believe what Cole was saying, maybe she could make the elephants' lives easier
by getting them to do tricks without being beaten or tortured.
Okay, let's say you're right. How are we going to convince Mr. Barlow? And what about Merrick?
Don't worry, he said. Just leave everything up to me.
Then, before she knew what was happening, Cole was in front of her, his warm hands on her shoulders. He pulled her close and kissed her long and hard on the lips. At first, she resisted, unsure if he was kissing her out of excitement or something else. Then he wrapped his arms around her and pressed his bare chest against her. Their naked stomachs touched, and the strange flutter in her stomach returned, stronger than ever. He kissed her harder, and she kissed him back, melting into his arms. This was what she wanted more than anything in the world. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she heard water splashing as Pepper and Flossie re-entered the pond. The balmy night caressed her skin as Cole's warm hands lowered the straps of her brassiere. Then they were naked in each other's arms on the grassy bank, and Cole moved above her, his wet body skimming hers. She shivered, and he looked into her eyes, as if asking permission to kiss her again. She'd always wondered what Glory meant when she said desire was a powerful thing. Now she knew. She pulled Cole to her and kissed him with an open mouth. He groaned and kissed her lips and neck and breasts and stomach. She trembled and arched her back. He moved up to kiss her neck again, and she wrapped her arms around his head. Then they began to make love beneath the stars, while the elephants frolicked and swam in the pond, enjoying their one night of freedom. Chapter 16. Julia. After finding her father's journal the day after the ice storm knocked the power out, Julia put her father's barn jacket on over her sweaters and pulled his lined trousers on over her pants. She put on an extra pair of socks and mother's boots, then carefully stepped out the mudroom door. Using a fireplace poker to break through the ice-encrusted snow, she slowly made her way across the yard to the barn, hunched over like an old woman with a cane, trying not to slip and fall. If anyone had seen her there, wearing baggy clothes, men's gloves, and rubber boots, her hair hanging out from beneath an oversized newsboy cap, they would have thought she was a crazy person escaped from the loony bin. The crack and crash of breaking trees echoed from the woods across the empty fields like random gunshots, though not as often as they had earlier that morning. Halfway to the barn, she looked toward the tree line, beyond the nearest pasture. Nothing broke the surface of the ice and snow. At the back of the property, a low jungle of underbrush and evergreens hung, weighed down under inches of ice, like praying monks with giant white hoods. Suddenly, the stillness was interrupted by a loud whooshing sound, like the roar of rushing water. A huge crash filled the air behind her, like a thousand exploding windows. She jumped and spun around to look at the house, her pulse pounding in her ears. At first, she saw nothing. Then she realized what made the noise. A massive sheet of ice had slid from the roof above the mudroom door and crashed to the ground, shattering on the planters and steps. If she had been on the steps, the ice would have hit her for sure. She looked up at the steep roof of the house and barn. If she was going to check on the horses without getting struck by a sudden avalanche of loose ice, when she was close to the buildings, she had to hurry. When she reached the barn, she hammered the office door handle with the fireplace poker to break the ice around it, working as fast as she could before another roof full of ice gave way. After several good blows, the ice broke free. She tried the handle, but the door wouldn't budge. She shoved her shoulder into the wood several times, until finally the ice along the frame split and the door wedged open. She broke the rest of the ice and pushed her way into the office. Even inside the barn, her breath billowed out in the freezing air. She pictured Samantha Blue shivering in the cold, ice hanging from her tiny nostrils, and rushed into the main part of the barn. The horses pushed their heads over their stalls to see who was there. When they saw her, they whinnied and nickered. She hurried over to the first stall and looked inside. The hay cradle was empty, and a thick sheet of ice covered the water trough. With her heart in her throat, she ran down the center aisle toward the empty door of Bonnie Blue's stall. Why wasn't she looking out? When Julia reached the stall, the blood drained from her face. Bonnie Blue was down in the straw, Samantha Blue on her side next to her belly. Julia held her breath and stared at them to see if they were breathing. They weren't moving. She was too late. She clamped a gloved hand over her mouth to stifle a sob. Then Blue raised her head and blinked. Samantha Blue woke up, lifted her head, then let it fall against her mother's belly, as if she were too tired to get up. Julia let out a sigh of relief, and her thundering heart slowed. Samantha saw her and struggled to stand, her long legs stiff and clumsy, like the limbs of a wooden puppet. Bonnie Blue pulled her hooves beneath her, got to her feet, and shook the straw from her mane. She nickered and came over to the stall door. Julia unlocked the stall and went inside. She smiled and gave Bonnie Blue and Samantha a good scratch and a kiss, then used the fireplace poker to break the ice in the water trough. Blue started drinking immediately, while Samantha nibbled at the pocket on Julia's jacket. Julia scratched her between the ears, gave her and Blue another kiss, then went out to get some hay. The other horses whinnied and kicked at their stall doors. "Don't worry," Julia said to them. "I'm coming." She pulled a bale of hay from the stack near the hayloft ladder and tried breaking the strings with her hands, but they were too strong and tight. She dragged the bale out to the aisle, pushed her foot against it to keep it from moving, and tugged a string from one corner with two hands. She had seen Claude undo a bale that way, but it was harder than it looked. Finally, the string came off, and the bale loosened. She yanked the other string off, and the bale broke into sections, like a deck of thick cards. She picked up the hay slices and divided them between the stalls, then broke the ice in all the troughs. The horses began to eat and drink right away, then thanked her by nudging her with soft noses, nuzzling her neck, and sniffing behind her ears. Remembering what Fletcher said about horses generating heat by eating hay, she broke up 10 more bales and divided them between the horses. When she finished, she stood in the center aisle and looked around, finally warm inside her coat. For the first time in her life, she felt loved and needed. "You're mine," she said to the horses, "and I promise to do my best to take care of you from now on." Outside, an engine sounded in the distance. It was getting closer. Julia went into the office, scraped a patch of ice off the window, and peered out. A vehicle pulled into the barn driveway, came to a stop, and the driver got out. It was Claude. Ever so slowly, he made his way toward the office, his arms out, as he tried not to fall on the ice. She opened the door to let him in. "What are you doing out here?" he said. His scowling face was red from the cold. She couldn't tell if he was concerned or angry.
"I came out to check on the horses."
Despite Claude's sour mood, a smile played around her lips. She had taken care of the horses all by herself. Claude harrumphed and went into the barn. She followed.
"They're fine," she said, hoping she sounded confident. "I broke the ice in the troughs and fed them hay. But thanks for coming out."
"Just doing my job."
He tromped down to Bonnie Blue's stall and looked over the door. Julia peered in, too. Blue chewed on a mouthful of hay while Samantha nursed, her fuzzy short tail wagging like a dog's.
"Any idea when the power will come back on?"
Julia said. Claude shook his head.
"Nope, it's out all over."
"Do I need to worry about the pipes in the house freezing?"
"If you think it'll help."
She furrowed her brow.
Why did he have to be so ornery? She was starting to wonder if he had always been a man of few words, or if he had something against her.
Is there anything we can do to prevent it from happening?
Claude opened the stall door, closed it behind him, and checked Samantha's navel.
Hope for warmer weather?
Julia crossed her arms over her chest. If he wasn't going to be friendly, maybe she could at least get some information out of him.
Can I ask you something?
Claude ran a hand over Blue's back and checked her bag.
What?
Were you working for my parents when my sister was born?
Claude straightened and kept his eyes on the horses, but Julia saw him flinch. It was the tiniest of movements, like a quick startle or a wince from a pulled muscle. Someone else might not have noticed, but she did. He ran a hand under Blue's neck.
I worked for your parents for 27 years.
So you know about my sister?
Claude came out of the stall, locked it, and started down the aisle.
I heard Mrs. Blackwood lost a child a few years back.
Julia drew in a quick breath and followed him.
Do you know what happened?
Nope.
Claude went into the office, got a bottle of iodine out of the medicine chest, then went back to Blue's stall. She went with him.
But you must know something. Fletcher said you and my father were friends.
Claude entered Blue's stall, got on his knees, and put iodine on Samantha's navel.
Did he?
He put the lid back on the iodine, got to his feet, and met Julia's eyes for the first time since his arrival.
Listen, I worked for Mr. and Mrs. Blackwood for a long time, but I have a policy never to get involved in my employer's personal business.
He dropped his eyes and opened the stall door, practically pushing her out of the way.
And that includes yours.
He went down to the tack room. She followed.
I just thought...
He stopped and turned to face her.
If you want help with the horses, that's fine. They belong to you now. I can't tell you what to do. But I've got to get Blue and her filly out of that stall and put in fresh straw. I don't have time for gossip.
Blood rose in Julia's cheeks. Suddenly she felt foolish. Standing there in her father's barn coat and oversized boots, the fingers of her gloves flopped over like a child playing dress-up. She searched Claude's face, trying to think of something to say. His eyes looked guarded. She wasn't going to get anywhere with him. Not today, anyway. She'd have to prove herself first.
All right, she said. I want to help.
He retrieved a miniature halter from the tack room, went back to Blue's stall, and tried to put the halter on Samantha. At first, she resisted, pulling away her little head and moving backward, her tiny hooves dancing in the straw. Then Claude wrapped an arm around her shoulders and rubbed the halter up and down her neck.
It's all right, he said in a calming voice. No one's gonna hurt you. See? It's just a halter.
He moved the halter over her ears and cheeks, as if petting her with it. To Julia's surprise, he sounded gentle and kind.
What are you doing?
She said in a quiet voice.
Showing her she doesn't need to be afraid of the halter by getting her used to the feel of it.
He continued rubbing the halter gently over Samantha's face while Blue stood watching and eating hay, unconcerned. After a few minutes, Samantha let him slip the halter over her head and buckle it. Once it was on, Claude let go. Samantha shook her head and pranced around the stall a few times, then pushed her nose beneath her mother's belly to nurse. Claude clipped a lead line onto Bonnie Blue's halter, asked Julia to open the door, and led the mare out of the stall. Samantha followed, her tiny hooves clip-clopping on the cement aisle. After Claude deposited Blue and her filly into another stall, he got a wheelbarrow from the far end of the barn and handed Julia a pitchfork.
Might as well learn how things work from the ground up, he said.
Julia took the pitchfork and went to work mucking out Blue's stall. If this was the only way she'd prove herself and get information out of Claude, it was going to be the cleanest stall he'd ever seen. Chapter 17. Lily. 2 days after Cole and Lily took the bulls swimming in the farm pond, Lily stood in front of Pepper in the center ring of the big top, while Cole watched from a few yards away in the hippodrome, or outer track. Mr. Barlow waited beside him, chewing the end of a fat cigar, his face twisted in irritation. Next to Mr. Barlow, Cole's father, Hank, held a bull hook in his hands, just in case.
"This better not be a waste of my time," Mr. Barlow said.
"It won't be," Cole said. "We only need a few minutes, that's all." He nodded once at Lily. "Go ahead." Lily took a deep breath and gazed into Pepper's eyes, trying to concentrate and silently begging her to do what was asked. If this went as planned, she could quit being the albino medium. She'd be working with Cole and the elephants, and hopefully there'd be less need for training ropes and bull hooks. Pepper looked bored and a little confused. Lily opened her mouth to give a command, then went over and gave Pepper's trunk a good rub instead.
"Please don't let me down, beautiful," she whispered. "This is for both of us."
Pepper made a deep rumbling noise in her throat, snuffled Lily's neck and hair, and gave her a big mushy kiss with the end of her trunk. Then she started to sway.
"Okay, I've seen enough," Mr. Barlow said. "The elephant likes her, so what?"
He started to walk away.
"No, wait," Cole said. "Just watch."
Lily moved back into position and said, "Up." Pepper stopped swaying, lifted her feet, and stood on her hind legs.
"On your head," Lily said.
In one fluid motion, Pepper rolled forward and balanced on her head and front feet, her giant back legs in the air. Lily glanced at Mr. Barlow to see his reaction, but his face gave nothing away. Cole and Hank, on the other hand, were grinning like fools.
"Down,"
Lily said. Pepper put her back legs down, got on her knees, and rolled over on her side. Lily took a step toward her, told her to get up, and said, "Lift!" Pepper got up on all four feet, curled her trunk under Lily like a swing, and lifted her gracefully over her head onto her neck. Lily smiled and put an arm in the air, imitating the other big top performers. Cole and Hank started clapping. Just then, the elephant trainer stormed into the arena.
"What in the hell is going on here? What are you doing with my bowl?" "I believe this is my bowl," Mr. Barlow said. "But I've been asking myself the same question," he addressed Cole. "What exactly is going on here?"
Cole gaped at Mr. Barlow as if he were the dumbest man on earth.
"Didn't you see what just happened?"
he said, throwing his arm out toward the center ring.
"Lily is a natural. 9 times out of 10, Pepper refuses to stand on her head, but she does it for Lily every time. The elephants respond to her like no one I've ever seen before. If you put Lily under the big top with Pepper, they'd be your star attraction for sure."
Mr. Barlow took the cigar from his mouth and scowled.
"Lily is already a star attraction, and so are the elephants. So why would I combine them and lose one? That's not good business sense, my boy. But I suppose that's why I'm the owner of this circus and you're not." He waved a dismissive hand in the air. "Now get her down off that bowl, take it back to the menagerie, and forget about this nonsense. We've got a show in 2 hours."
Lily slid down Pepper's side to the ground and stood beside her, surprised by the depth of her disappointment. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she knew Mr. Barlow would never allow her to perform with the bowls. But Cole had been so sure about the plan, she'd begun to believe in it too. Now she had to settle back into the fact that she'd be the albino medium forever. Anger and frustration lined Cole's forehead.
"If Lily is one of your star attractions," he said, "maybe Merrick should start paying her."
With that, Mr. Barlow's face went dark.
"As long as Merrick pays me my share of her take, I don't give a damn what he does with his."
He gave Hank a disgusted look.
"I'm surprised you were a part of this."
"He wasn't," Cole said. "He brought Pepper over here, that's it. I didn't tell him why."
"Enough out of you," Mr. Barlow snarled at Cole. "This circus has been running for over 20 years now, without any help from young smart-ass whippersnappers like you.
Now get back to work before I fire the lot of you. He stuffed the cigar back in his mouth and marched out of the big top. Lily looked at Cole and shrugged, blinking back tears. Chapter 18. Julia. The evening following the ice storm, after Julia and Claude were finished with the horses and Claude had left for home, Julia took an oil lantern into her father's den to search for more information about her late sister. The electricity was still out, and ice-encased branches trembled outside the windows, rattling against one another like bones. But despite the fact that she could see her breath in the freezing room, and she was exhausted after cleaning stalls half the day, she couldn't ignore the burning need to find the truth. She set the lantern on the desk, opened the middle drawer, and searched inside for the key to the locked drawer. It had to be in there somewhere. She reached into the back corners, felt along the lining for the shape of a key, and came up empty-handed. She tried picking the lock with a bobby pin, but had no idea what she was doing. She shoved a letter opener between the desk frame and the top of the locked drawer to pry it open. The letter opener broke in two, and she jammed her fist against the wood. "Shit!" she hissed. She dropped the letter opener and examined her knuckles. Divots of ripped skin flopped open on each one, exposing raw flesh underneath. Now, along with blisters on her palms from shoveling horse manure, she had scrapes on her knuckles, too. Swearing again, she covered her knuckles with her hand until they stopped throbbing, then carefully searched through the papers in the rest of the drawers. She took them out one by one and held them close to the lantern, squinting to read the fine print. They were business letters, indecipherable doctor's prescriptions, pay stubs, old bills, and receipts. Nothing of any significance. Frustrated, she stood and looked around the room as if the answer was hidden there. Lantern light flickered off the walls and bookshelves, reflecting in the trophies and picture frames like tiny flames. She made her way along the shelves and scanned the titles. Then, starting at the bottom of the first bookcase, she riffed through the pages of each book before returning it to the shelf and moving on to the next. The dusty pages made her sneeze. She worked fast, trying to keep warm, and anxious to find the key to the locked drawer, or hopefully more clues about her sister and what her parents might have done. Along with numerous volumes on horse breeds and veterinary medicine, there were novels, poem collections, reference books, and outdated encyclopedias. She climbed on a footstool to examine a set of six antique books with worn leather spines sitting between elephant-shaped bookends on the top shelf of the center bookcase. The dust was thicker on these books than the rest, and the pages were thin and yellowed. When she picked up the fourth book, she was surprised to discover it weighed almost nothing, despite the fact that it was the same size as the others. She got down from the footstool, opened the book, and gasped. The center of the book had been cut out to form a box inside the pages, and a small pile of yellowed newspaper clippings and other papers filled the space, stacked like pressed flowers in a haphazard pile. She took the book over to the desk and sat down, trembling with anticipation. Blowing into her hands to warm them first, she took out one of the clippings and opened it with gentle fingers, careful not to rip the paper. The headline of the article read, "Circus Comes to Langhorne, Pennsylvania." Below the headline, grainy black and white pictures showed two men in tuxedos and two women in evening gowns holding the halters of four white horses. In the middle of the horses, a man in a top hat and long fur coat smiled at the camera. Julia scanned the article. Why had her father felt the need to hide an article about a circus? She picked up the next item. It was a ticket stub from the Barlow Brothers Circus. She looked at the article again. It was the same circus.
The next clipping featured a photo of what looked like a pretty white-haired woman in a white dress and pearl choker. Her hair was swept back with pearl barrettes, and she looked off in the distance, her mouth in a thin line, as if she were trying not to cry. The caption below read, "The Albino Medium." Another article announced the circus was coming to Saratoga, New York, and pictured what looked like the same woman sitting on the curled trunk of an elephant. This time she was smiling, one bejeweled arm in the air, her ballet-slippered feet pointed downward. There were more articles and ticket stubs from different towns in New York, Pennsylvania, Vermont, and Connecticut, all to the Barlow Brothers Circus. Julia's mind raced. Her father never took her to the circus. So where did all the ticket stubs come from? Why was he so interested in this particular circus? And why did he feel the need to hide these articles and ticket stubs? Why did it seem like most of the articles featured the pretty albino woman? Was it a coincidence? Did they have an affair? Is that why he went to the circus so much? Was that why he drank? Because they couldn't be together? Was his transgression coupled with the loss of their first child the reason behind mother's misery? Julia put the clippings and ticket stubs back in the book, shivering and more confused than ever. She wanted to stay in the den to keep searching for clues and the key to the locked drawer, but it was too cold. She needed to get back to the fireplace. Not only that, but she hadn't eaten since morning, and her stomach cramped with hunger. She left the book on the desk, grabbed the lantern, and headed into the hall. In the living room, she knelt in front of the fireplace, trying to get warm and staring into the flames, thinking, thinking. A quiet desperation gathered beneath her ribs. She had to know more about her dead sister, about her father's secrets, about her parents and what they had done. A piece of burning bark stuck to the grate in the fireplace, turning gray and curling toward the chimney, hypnotizing her. Three insistent knocks on the mudroom door made her jump. She got to her feet. Who could possibly be at the door at this hour, and in this weather? Claude had left hours ago. Maybe someone's car had broken down, and they wanted to use her telephone. Three more knocks, louder and more demanding with every blow. She hurried across the living room toward the kitchen, then stopped, suddenly nervous. If someone needed help, they'd be at the front door, not the side door. And she was alone in the house, 2 miles from the nearest neighbor. She blew out the lantern and waited to see if the person would give up and go away. "Julia?" a man's voice called. It was Fletcher. She let out a sigh of relief. "Coming!" she called out, feeling a little foolish. She relit the lantern, went to the mudroom, and unlocked the door to let him in. He blew into the house and stomped his boots on the rug, his face ruddy below a fur-lined aviator hat. He smelled like winter and hay and woodsy cologne. Julia's heart lifted at the sight of a friendly face. "What are you doing way out here at this hour?" she said. "Did you stop by the barn? Is everything all right?"
"The horses are doing great," he said. "But I wanted to make sure you're okay, too."
She smiled. "I'm fine, thanks. A little cold, but fine."
"You have the fireplace going?"
"Yes." He hunched his shoulders and shoved his gloved hands in his coat pockets.
"Brr, it's freezing out there. Is there anything I can do for you? Bring in more firewood? Check the faucets?"
She frowned. "Check the faucets. For what?"
"You should let them drip so the pipes won't freeze."
"Claude didn't tell me that." He grinned.
"I told you, Claude doesn't talk much."
"I know, but I specifically asked him about the pipes freezing." She briefly considered asking if he knew anything about her dead sister, then remembered he'd only been working at Blackwood Manor a few months before her father died. Fletcher hadn't spent enough time with him to learn anything about her family. "I was glad Claude made it over here to check on the horses, though."
"Yeah, you can always depend on Claude for that."
He took off his gloves, went into the kitchen, and turned on the faucet just enough to make it drip. Then he looked at her and waited.
What?
She said.
Do you want to show me where the rest of the faucets are?
She thought about showing him the 8 bathroom faucets, but changed her mind. If all she had to do was make them drip, she could handle it.
That's all right, I can take care of them.
He shrugged.
Okay. What about wood? Do you have enough?
I think so.
Try not to open the fridge too much, he said.
Your food will stay cold longer that way.
She glanced at the refrigerator.
Okay.
Of course, you can always set it out on the steps. It's certainly cold enough out there.
The refrigerator? I don't think I can lift it.
She smiled, and he laughed.
Ah, that was a good one, he said. You got me.
He put his gloves back on and went to the door.
Well, I guess I better get going. It's going to be a treacherous drive home.
She thought about asking him to stay for a while, but didn't want him to think she was flirting. After all, he could be married for all she knew. But then he started to open the door, and she realized she didn't want to be alone. The words came out before she could stop them.
Why don't you come in and get warmed up before you head back out?
There's food if you're hungry, and brandy.
He grinned, closed the door, and took off his gloves again.
Brandy sounds good.
Okay.
She went to the cupboard and grabbed 2 juice glasses.
I'm not sure where the snifters are.
No worries, I'm a vet, remember? I've been known to drink out of cow troughs if I'm thirsty enough.
She made a face.
Yuck.
Hey, don't knock it until you've tried it.
It's especially good when it's been sitting in the sun for a few days. Gives it that little extra zing.
Shaking her head and laughing, she led him into the living room. The fire was dying down. She set the juice glasses on the coffee table in front of the couch.
Would you mind throwing on a few more logs while I get the brandy?
Not at all.
She hurried toward the den to fetch the brandy, surprised at how happy she was to have a visitor. After the ice storm, worrying about the horses, finding out she had a sister, and the mysterious discoveries in her father's den, maybe having company would get her mind off things for a little while. When she came back into the living room, Fletcher was leaning back on the couch like he belonged there, relaxed and enjoying the fire, one ankle crossed over his knee. She held up the brandy bottle and smiled.
It's old, but it should be fine.
Well, I guess we'll find out, won't we? He said. She filled the glasses halfway, handed him one, and sat on the couch beside him. He took a swig and grimaced a little.
Is it horrible?
No, it's fine.
You didn't look like it was fine. You made a face.
He grinned.
I have a confession to make. I'm not a brandy drinker. Beer is normally my spirit of choice.
Then why did you...
Because a night like this calls for brandy.
He drained his glass, set it on the coffee table, and swallowed, trying to keep a straight face.
And you look like you needed some company.
Her cheeks grew warm, and she fixed her eyes on the fire. Why did he always assume he knew what she needed?
Would you like another?
No, thanks. He sat forward, his elbows on his knees, and gazed into the fire. She sipped her drink and watched him out of the corner of her eye, wondering why he agreed to stay. If she didn't know better, she might have thought he took her up on the brandy just to spend time with her. But that was impossible. He was a veterinarian with a college degree, and she had never graduated high school. Someone as handsome and accomplished as he surely had a girlfriend, or a fiancé, or a wife. Maybe even a couple of kids and a dog. She shook her head and tried to think rationally. He had come here to check on the horses and only took her up on her invitation because he was kind. That was it. And truth be told, she was grateful to meet someone kind at Blackwood Manor. Maybe he was right. Maybe she did need company. Despite her earlier decision not to ask if he knew anything about her parents and sister, she changed her mind. Kind people like to help others, and she certainly needed help. Maybe he'd heard something while working here, if not from Claude, from someone else.
After all, he knew the other horse farmers in the area, and people loved to talk.
Can I ask you something?
He grinned.
Am I single?
Yes.
Her face grew hot again.
That's not what I was going to say.
How come I'm not married?
He raised his palms as if confessing a crime.
I guess I just haven't found the right person yet.
After all, it takes a special woman to appreciate someone like me. I'm handsome, charming, well-educated. And who could resist a guy who wears shit-covered boots and sticks their hands up cows' asses all day?
He leaned back, put his arm across the back of the couch, and cast her a wry smile.
What about you? Are you single, or will I have to fight someone for your affections?
She couldn't seem to answer him. She had forgotten how to breathe, as if taking in air no longer followed letting it out. Suddenly, she felt like they were too close. But he didn't move, and neither did she. He gave her a bemused look. Then gradually, his expression changed and grew more serious. She felt like she might dissolve under his scrutiny. She stood, picked up their glasses, and headed toward the kitchen.
"You should probably go," she said. "It's late, and I need some sleep. Thanks for your help."
He got up and followed her.
"No problem," he said, sounding puzzled.
She went to the sink, and he went to the door.
"I'll come back tomorrow and check the pipes."
"All right, I'll see you then. Thanks again."
"Night."
He smiled awkwardly and let himself out into the freezing night. After he was gone, she leaned against the counter and tried to clear her head. She had no idea if he was trying to be funny or sincere. And to her surprise, she felt like a schoolgirl with a new crush, with sweaty palms and quivering knees. But that was impossible. She had just met him. She didn't even know if she trusted him. Hell, after everything she'd been through, she didn't trust anyone.
Chapter 19. Lily. 3 weeks after Cole tried to convince Mr. Barlow to put Lily in the elephant act, the Barlow Brothers Circus landed its biggest venue yet, in a town outside New York City on the 4th of July weekend. It was their first time performing at that spot, and Mr. Barlow and Merrick barked orders nonstop. Inside the dressing tent, Glory finished fixing Lily's hair and helped her with her pearl necklace.
"Are you nervous?" she said. "Mr. Barlow says everything has to go off without a hitch so we can come back next year."
"No," Lily said. "But the bigger the venue, the more people I have to lie to."
"I know," Glory said. "But even if what you're doing isn't real, at least it makes the Rubes happy to think they're talking to their lost loved ones."
"That's what I keep trying to tell myself," Lily said. "But what happens when everyone finds out I'm nothing but a gaffe?"
"You need to quit worrying ahead," Glory said. "It won't change anything."
Merrick stuck his head inside the tent.
"Let's go, Lily."
She stood, gave Glory a hug, and left with Merrick. Over the next few hours, the Rubes coming inside the albino medium's tent ran the entire gamut. From men looking to connect with their long-departed mothers, to little old ladies desperate to hear from their dead cats. When Pierre meowed from inside the wardrobe, and the gray-haired lady with a sweet smile sitting across from Lily started to cry, it was all she could do not to get up and walk out. Until the chance to do something else had presented itself in the form of working with elephants, she hadn't fully realized how weary she was of this gig. And she knew in her heart of hearts the day would come when she would make a mistake and someone would peg her as fake. Then there would be hell to pay. After the gray-haired lady left, Merrick gave Lily two names instead of the usual one, because the next Rube insisted on trying to reach two dead family members. As soon as Merrick left, a big surly man in a worn jacket and dungarees limped into the tent. He looked to be about 40, his grimy face covered with 2 or 3 days' worth of beard, his hair sticking out in all directions,
the smell of stale beer and cigarettes wafting from his clothes. Scowling, he fell into the seat across from Lily, then sat forward, his elbows on the table as if ready to arm wrestle a sworn enemy. Lily swallowed, her mouth suddenly parched.
"Hello and welcome," she said. "Before we begin, let me tell you a little bit about what I do. I've been communicating with the dead since the age of 4, and eventually came to realize I needed to share my gift. Messages from the beyond can come in the form of music, voices, and other sounds. What I'd like you to do is close your eyes and think about your departed loved one. While you're doing that, I'll try to connect with the spirit world. Then I'll ask you some questions, to which you must answer either yes or no. Are you ready to begin?"
"Name's John," the man said.
She blinked at him, confused. "Is that your name or the name of the person you hope to reach?"
"Mine."
"All right, John. Please relax, close your eyes, and think about the person you'd like to hear from today."
"I'll do no such thing," John said.
Lily tensed. Here we go, she thought. My first difficult rube of the day. "I'm sorry," she said, "but perhaps you misunderstood. Would you like to tell me something about yourself? Maybe that will..."
"I lost my wife and son in a car wreck a year ago. But you already knew that, didn't you?"
She shook her head. "No, I didn't know. But I'm very sorry for your loss. It must be extremely hard for you. If you'll give me a chance, I can try to reach them for you."
John fixed his watery gaze on her. "It was my fault, 'cause I was drinking. And I've been trying to tell them sorry ever since." He cleared his throat. "I've been to all sorts of people saying they could talk to my wife and boy, that they could bring them into the room so I could ask their forgiveness. That's all I want. I just want to say I'm sorry."
His face contorted in misery. "I understand," she said. "Why don't we see if I can help?" She closed her eyes and waited a few seconds before continuing, guilt churning in her stomach. The agony on John's face burned itself into her memory next to the thousands of other rubes she had tricked into believing she could speak to their loved ones on the other side.
"I'm seeing the figure of a young woman. She's very pretty. I believe her name is Lisa. No, that's not right. It's Lynette."
"Stop it," John said in a hard voice.
Lily opened her eyes.
"Excuse me?"
"I said stop it."
"I'm sorry, I don't understand. Is something wrong? Sometimes it takes a little while to get..."
"Yeah, something's wrong," John interrupted. He glared at her. "You're a fake, just like the rest of them. Mediums, spirit guides, seance holders, every last one of y'all is a goddamn fake."
He spit the words out like poison.
"I'm sorry," she said again, "but
I just want to know one thing. What kind of person takes a hard-working man's money and lies right to their face about their dead kin?"
She shook her head.
I don't know, but if you'll just..."
John shot to his feet and slammed his fists on the table, rattling the candle holders and bell globe.
"Don't lie to me," he shouted, his chest heaving in and out. "I know this is a setup."
Lily got out of her chair and backed away, starting to shake.
"Now listen, John, if you'll just calm down, we can give you your money."
John stormed over to the wardrobe and yanked on the door handles. When they didn't open, he smashed his fist through the wood, reached in, and dragged Pierre out by the scruff of his shirt.
"Who's this?" he snarled.
"Let go of me,"
Pierre shouted.
He tried punching John in the stomach, but his short arms wouldn't reach.
John lifted him in the air and shook him.
"Don't!" Lily shouted. "Please, it's not his fault!"
Just then, the back entrance flew open and Merrick rushed in, threw an arm around John's broad neck and tried to wrestle him to the ground. Pierre yanked himself from John's grasp and scurried out of the way, his face white as a sheet. John pulled away from Merrick, then turned and threw a punch at him. Merrick ducked
and John fell forward, landing on his knees. Then he found his footing, stood, and upended the table with one swipe of his arm.